And now it's time for our Wisconsin News Roundup, where we cover the biggest stories from around the state each week.
Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of Dontre Hamilton's death at the hands of a Milwaukee police officer. We discuss how some honored the anniversary and how recent events in Baltimore relate to Hamilton's death.
The state Supreme Court chose a new Chief Justice this week, replacing Shirley Abrahamson while she challenges the ruling in court.
And signs say we may be getting closer to a new Milwaukee Bucks arena. We'll talk about all these stories right now with WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here, and happy Pledge Week.
Almost over.
Within hours.
Well, tomorrow, now, too.
Right, tomorrow too. Tomorrow evening. Yeah.
Well, let's look at our Wisconsin news this week. We mentioned the anniversary of the shooting death of Dontre Hamilton.
Right. So yesterday was the anniversary of Dontre Hamilton's death. He was shot and killed by a police officer at a public park in Milwaukee. Hamilton, as you might remember, was unarmed, and the officer has since been fired. The incident really spawned several protests over the past year, including one that took place yesterday in Milwaukee.
Yeah, so what happened yesterday?
So around 100 people marched from the city's near west side to Red Arrow Park, where Hamilton was killed. Nearly a dozen protesters laid on their backs, and members of Hamilton's family spoke during the protest. This latest rally, and really the anniversary itself, comes during a week where, you know, once again, the nation is grappling with the aftermath of another police-involved death involving a black man, this time in Baltimore.
And we've had news updates today. The prosecutor there in Baltimore is filing charges against the six police officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray. Bring us back. What happened to the police officer involved in the shooting death here in Milwaukee of Dontre Hamilton?
Yeah, so Christopher Manny actually was fired by the Milwaukee Police Department for not following procedure. He appealed that decision but has since lost. He was not charged criminally by the DA in Milwaukee. The DA in that city did investigate the incident, but found there was no basis for criminal charges. Hamilton's family still hopes that the Justice Department, the federal Justice Department, will take some sort of action based on the case, but that remains to be seen.
As we've said, a lot of these stories going on in the country, not just in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, also we're watching, waiting to hear the results of an investigation in Madison, looking into the shooting death of an unarmed African-American 19-year-old by a police officer. What's the latest there?
Right. So in recent weeks, like in Milwaukee, there have been several protests against the killing of Tony Robinson. The investigation itself has actually been completed, and the results have been turned over to the DA in Dane County. We are awaiting a decision by his office on whether or not Officer Matt Kenny will actually be charged in the case. They received the results of that investigation a few weeks ago. We're still waiting on a decision. Regardless of what it is, you know, I would expect there to be, you know, more protests certainly in Madison in the coming weeks.
All right. Well, let's move on to the Milwaukee Bucks arena question. This has been up in the air, different proposals floated. What are we seeing now? It seems like something's coming down to the wire.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can tell because of who's getting involved at this point. Governor Walker is actually taking a break from his, you know, unofficial campaign for president and getting directly involved in the negotiations. I think that's probably a sign of how serious people are taking this issue. Walker has said this week that they are close to a deal. They have not reached one, but they are close to a financing deal for a new arena.
And what's the sticking point?
The big question here, Rob, the big one is how much of the financing pie is the state, the city, the county actually going to pick up to make this deal a reality? As Sean Johnson actually reported a little bit earlier on this week, there isn't much talk about the owners of the Bucks actually pitching in more money. So it appears it will really be up to state, county, and city government to make up the balance of the cost.
So on the public funding side, what are we floating here? What's being talked about?
Well, the former and current owners of the team are prepared to spend about $250 million on the deal. That leaves roughly $250 million that needs to be found somewhere. And the debate now is, where is that somewhere?
Mm-hmm. And so where would that come from? What's the state been talking about?
So initially, Governor Walker had proposed a $220 million bonding plan. Other proposals have called for greater involvement by the city and county, financial involvement. This entire conversation, it has to be said, though, comes at a time when the city of Milwaukee, the county, and the state are short on funds. So, you know, any decision that is made about this financing deal for the arena, it's going to be controversial.
Mm-hmm. And so what's at stake? I mean, is there a risk of losing the team, having the Bucks move elsewhere?
Well, it depends on who you ask what the stake is, but the owners have said they would consider taking the team elsewhere if they don't get a new arena. You know, this is a scenario, frankly, that plays out in city after city, and right now it's Milwaukee's turn to deal with a prospect.
Well, briefly, the state Supreme Court, a new chief maybe?
Yeah, this at best, I have to say, is an awkward turn of events for the state Supreme Court. Justices on the Supreme Court picked a new chief this week, as you talked about at the beginning of the segment. The four conservative judges picked Justice Patient Rogensack. She replaces Shirley Abrahamson. Why is this awkward? Why is this significant? It's significant because Abrahamson says she is still the chief of the Supreme Court.
So briefly, this goes back to that vote we had changing how the state chief justice gets selected.
Right. So Wisconsin residents last month voted to amend the Constitution so that the chief is actually elected by their peers and not through seniority, which had been the case for, you know, 100 plus years. Abrahamson is the longest serving justice, so she held the title.
So this is going to be what? This court issue is going to be in the courts still.
Right. So Patience Rogensack, according to the Supreme Court, she is the current chief now. You know, whether it stays that way, who knows? Abrahamson has a hearing in her case scheduled for May 15th. So, you know, as I often say on this show, stay tuned to find out who the chief is.
We'll check in with you on this one again, I'm sure. Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That's WPR's assistant news director, Noah Ovshinsky, bringing us up to speed on the biggest headlines around the state in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
The relisting of the gray wolf as an endangered species in the Western Great Lakes region has renewed debate over its recovery and how to manage wolves. As Danielle Kading reports, the back and forth in the wolf's federally protected status may affect its recovery.
55 years ago, gray wolves were non-existent in Wisconsin. Since then, their numbers have grown to just under 700. Dave McFarland is a large carnivore specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. McFarland says the back and forth with the wolf status changes how they manage them.
Now that we have implemented a hunting and trapping season in the state that was designed to reduce the population and was effective in doing so, that's a pretty significant change in the management of the species.
Wisconsin began holding a hunt in 2012, but a federal judge's ruling put them back on the endangered species list last year, banning future hunts in Great Lakes states. Despite the ruling, wildlife managers largely agree the gray wolf is recovered in the region. Pete Fassbender is a field supervisor with the Wisconsin Ecological Services Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says the change in status shakes public trust.
You have producers that are trying to make a livelihood. They're affected by wolf depredations, and you have folks that really love wolves, and their wolves are being taken. It's kind of this balancing, right? And the public hears this, and they just lose faith that the government can manage wildlife.
A group of researchers released findings last fall about what happened to wolves in Wisconsin during recent shifts in their status. Eric Olson is an assistant professor of natural resources at Northland College. Olson says they found fewer wolves were killed illegally when state managers could kill wolves to resolve conflicts.
When they lost that authority, or when there was a year where they had less authority to do that control, illegal killing increased.
Dave Rood says one reason may be that alternatives to deter wolves, like lights or sirens, don't always work. Rood is a supervisory wildlife biologist with USDA Wildlife Services in Wisconsin.
Most would argue that probably there's greater illegal mortality when people become frustrated. They're trying to resolve conflicts on their own. Limited site selective lethal control of depredating wolves has not impeded wolf recovery across the Western Great Lakes region.
But that's not the issue for Melissa Tedrow, state director of the Humane Society. Tedrow says she doesn't trust the state to manage wolves when it approved a wolf hunt.
There may be a wolf that's causing a problem, but to have an indiscriminate hunt, taking out packs, threatening the species, it's not warranted and it doesn't work.
For Wisconsin's Native American tribes, wolf protection is a matter of respect for an animal they view as a brother. Peter David is a wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, which represents 11 Ojibwe tribes in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
The tribes have supported keeping wolves on the endangered species list because culturally they see the kind of protections that are provided by that as being appropriate for wolves.
David says finding a middle ground on management begins with people feeling like they have a say in the process. With that in mind, the DNR's McFarland says the state conducted a survey last year of factors that influence people's attitudes toward wolves. He says that will guide an update of Wisconsin's wolf management plan.
It's not meant to be a referendum or a vote. It's meant to be another piece of scientific data to inform the decision-making process in the same way that our biological data does.
McFarland says it's then up to the decision-makers how to use that information. He says they hope to get public input on an updated plan this summer and present it to the Natural Resources Board in the fall. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Ashland.
And now for more on wolf management, we're joined by WPR's reporter in Superior, Danielle Kading. Danielle, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. Can you give us a sense of how sensitive a topic wolf management is in northern Wisconsin?
Well, it's pretty sensitive in northwestern Wisconsin in particular because there's a band from about Ashland west to Superior where they see the most wolf livestock issues. In fact, the state says the number of conflicts have been cut in half since they began a wolf hunt. In 2010, there were 70 cattle killed, and now that was down to about 33 last year. And so the number of conflicts are more frequent up here just because there's more density of wolves.
And as we heard in your piece, it sounds as though there seems to be broad agreement that the wolf population has recovered. What does that seem to mean going forward?
Well, a couple of things. Right now, the state is updating its wolf management plan, and they have four alternatives on the table that they're looking at. One is to have a minimum population where they would basically maintain the population as it is right now at around 650 wolves. The second, they would have about 350, which is the current number that they have outlined in their current wolf management plan. The third would be to have a range of from about 350 to 650. And the fourth would be to have a population maintained, not based on a number. It backs away from that. And that's the last option that folks with the Humane Society of the United States would like to see. They don't want to see wolf management or wolf recovery based on a number. They say that there has been a rush to enact wolf hunts after delistings have occurred and that wolves have been aggressively killed at high levels. And there were 154 wolves killed in a wolf hunt last year. But the DNR cites recent studies saying that the state could support maybe 700 to 1,000 wolves, but that probably wouldn't be socially tolerated because of the conflicts that result.
And with those four options that you just put on the table, how do you expect interested parties to try to move forward and come to some kind of consensus?
Well, that's kind of the difficult question because everybody has a different point of view, a different perception of wolves and their recovery. You know, we have people like the Humane Society on one end that are saying that we need to protect the wolf, that otherwise if there is no protection for it, then there's going to be this wolf hunt, which is mandated by state law, and that they feel that they would be aggressively killed if not. You know, on the other side of that, you have the state saying that, you know, the wolf population has grown at highs at points to more than 800, and that that's causing more conflicts with livestock producers, and they're paying out more compensation from the state. They paid out $151,000 last year because of wolf conflicts to producers. So there's a lot of back and forth, and then you have the Native American tribes who don't want to see the wolf killed at all because they view the wolf as a brother. And so it's just a lot of different perspectives, and it's hard to find a middle ground in there. And I think
And we'll be watching that. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior, giving us the latest on wolf management in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
Breaking news out of Baltimore this morning. Warrants were issued for the six officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray.
The Baltimore City State's attorney has ruled that the death of Freddie Gray was a homicide. She based her decision on her office's investigation and a medical examiner's report.
The ruling comes in the wake of local and national protests. Some were scheduled to coincide with May Day marches today. Joining us is Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of ColorOfChange.org, an online civil rights organization. Rashad, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your reaction to the announcement this morning that the officers involved in Freddie Gray's death, it's going to be treated as a homicide, first of all, and six officers will be charged with a range of crimes?
Well, I think it's an incredible victory for the organizing. I think State Attorney Mosley needs to be really heralded and championed for doing this. She did something that almost no prosecutor does around the country, and as an organization that continues to show up when black people are harmed or hurt by police, and over again, we see no accountability. What happened here today in Baltimore, in the state of Maryland, is remarkable and hopefully a turning point in what's possible when these situations happen.
To what extent does this announcement meet protesters' grievances? What still needs to be tackled here?
Well, I mean, this is just one small piece of the larger set of grievances. I mean, throughout this whole, two-plus weeks of protests, we have seen Baltimore police continue to act with impunity, continue to treat the community as enemy combatants. And that doesn't change with this prosecution. But this prosecution is a step in the right direction. We cannot have a sense of justice, a sense of fairness, a sense of community coming together if there's no accountability for police officers. The indictment does not mean a conviction, though. And so there is still work ahead. There will still have to be the resources put behind a rigorous prosecution. And all of those things still need to happen. But this is an important step along the road, something that those out in the street protesting wanted. But it by no means means that we have put in place the type of structural changes that our communities desperately need.
Well, what are those structural changes? What needs to happen now and maybe after the spotlight goes away?
Well, there's a couple of things that need to happen. Right now, we have no federal database on when someone's hurt or killed by police, so we don't actually have a larger sense of the problem, both locally and nationally. We need, not just in the state of Maryland, but in other states around the country, to pull out these investigations from police departments when something like this happens. Police, over and over again, have proven that they simply cannot police themselves. And why should we expect that to be the case? And so in these situations, we need to put in place special prosecutors so that fairness and justice is incentivized. Prosecutors are oftentimes not incentivized. It's why what happened in Baltimore is so remarkable, because prosecutors need police to do their job. And so those are just, two things. The addition of body cameras, the addition of more community policing and accountability at the local level for police departments, and more police being held accountable when these situations happen. These are all type of structural changes that go beyond one individual case and start producing and pushing a culture where community can feel like they can trust law enforcement. Because at the end of the day, that's going to be really important for communities to feel like they can call law enforcement when they need them. And that's not what's happening in so many communities around the country.
In an article on The Root this morning, you criticized the media for failing to tell the whole story of Baltimore. What is missing from what you're seeing in the media?
Well, over and over again, we saw the media, call the protesters names like thugs, talk about, the loss of property over the loss of black lives. For weeks, people had been protesting peacefully, and the media never showed up. And then the media showed up and blamed the protesters for the situation, and almost a throwback to, protesters being blamed for protesting during the Civil Rights Movement, or protesters being blamed for protesting during the Stonewall riots, and not looking at the underlying causes of why people were protesting in the first place, why communities were standing up and pushing back. The media coverage that we continue to see sits inside of a larger challenge we have with media that doesn't tell the full story. Color of Change actually looked at the local news coverage in New York, for instance. And we picked New York because the local news coverage oftentimes sets a standard for other places around the country. And we looked at how they covered crime by race, looking at the arrest records by race and looking at when they identified suspects by race. And saw a distortion rate at 20 to 40%. meaning that local news stations were actually overrepresenting the amount of black suspects in crime that was actually happening, sort of in proportion, and underrepresenting white crime. And so we continue to see that in cities and places all around the country that feeds this type of bias, that feeds this type of culture, that puts communities in harm's way and makes these situations somewhat acceptable to maybe people. And so we think there's a lot of work to do in holding media accountable, as much as we have to do work to push for policy change.
Talking to Rashad Robinson with Color of Change about the latest news from Baltimore and more long-term issues as well. And let's go long-term, Rashad. I mentioned, after the cameras are gone, when the story is happening in another city, if we take a community like Baltimore or Ferguson, Missouri, or New York, or insert a city here, what do we need to do to change things fundamentally so that we're not talking about this story again in 5 or 10 or 20 years in that city?
I mean, what we're seeing in these cities when people show up is because there is no sense of justice. You know, when the situation that recently happened in South Carolina, where the video surfaced of the police officer shooting the unarmed man in the back, you know, we instantly saw community respond, but we saw the local officials respond as well. And as a result, there was a much different reaction locally. So this idea that we need special prosecutors, we need new structures to ensure that justice is served, will, I believe, bring about different type of responses from community. Community need to believe that they are heard and that they are counted and that their voices and their humanity is visible in our society. And when that doesn't happen, people are going to stand up and fight back. We, I think, are entering a new phase of participation with communities believing that enough is enough. And we saw young activists draw the line in the sand in Ferguson. We saw young activists show up in Baltimore. We are in a different age with technology, social media, the ability to leverage video content. All of those things are going to make it much harder for the status quo to sort of exist, where police departments can act with impunity and believe that there's going to be no consequence.
So you write that there's a very real potential right now to build lasting change from the Baltimore uprising. What does it take to make sure that, I guess, we keep an eye on the ball and make those changes while the attention is there?
Well, I think it's going to, I think how we move this issue that has deep cultural presence, where people are talking about it on the news, how we translate that cultural presence to the cultural power that makes change is that these young black folks and brown folks who have been in the streets and young white folks who I've met out in the streets who have been raising their voices and pushing back, while their voices are being heard, more people need to stand up and get involved. We need more allies, more people to see this as their fight, to see this struggle is about making America whole, about making our communities places where all of us are valued and treated with respect. And so in keeping our eye on the ball, for people who are listening at home and are outraged by this, this is a moment. This is our moment to look back and say five years from now or 10 years from now and say, this is the moment when I got involved and I stood up. I called my representative. I pushed for legislation locally and nationally. We do have the opportunity at the federal level to get some executive orders that deal with this, but also some potential for bipartisan legislation. And we're also entering a presidential election season where the candidates are going to be coming to all of our communities and asking us what we care about. And we're really putting issues on the table. And this just can't be an issue for the black community. It has to be an issue for all of our communities. Our ability to be safe, our ability to be treated with fairness, is something that affects all of us, and all of us have to have skin in the game.
Do you expect to see more protests in Baltimore and elsewhere after today? Do you hope to see more protests?
Absolutely, I hope to see more protests, and there will be more protests. Until there's structural changes, we will continue to see these incidents happen. We will continue to see them happen in the communities. And time again, my organization shows up, and we push, and we fight, and we raise our voices, and we demand for legislation, and we demand to hold media accountable. And I believe that until the actual change happens, people will continue to fight, continue to raise their voices, and continue to welcome more people into the struggle.
Rashad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Rashad Robinson, executive director of ColorofChange.org, talking about the charges filed today against six Baltimore police officers.